This is an ABC podcast.
Love them or hate them, drones are here to stay. And let's face it, while they might ruin the serenity of a good hike or a picnic in the park, they are extremely useful. Today on Future Tense, we'll talk to an Adelaide-based scientist who's managed to replace that annoying buzzing sound with something like this. And if that sounds more like a mechanical insect than a mini helicopter, that's the point. A biologically inspired micro drone that flaps and claps. We'll find out why and how a little later in the show. And staying with drones, we'll also hear from this person.
I'm Annette McClellan from Takuma. I founded this company with my co-founder Michael Griffin. What we've invented is a tactile 6 degrees of freedom control orb. It works with drones, robots, and other devices. We reduce the time, cost, personnel, and training required to get the job done.
Annette McClellan, that's all to come. Hello, Anthony Fennell here. Thanks for joining us.
You're with Future Tense on RN, ABC Radio National, exploring the world around us, looking for the pathways ahead, and signposting the future.
First up today, artificial intelligence and algorithms. They're now being used to make decisions about almost everything. But one perhaps unexpected area where AI is starting to have a presence is in family law. Professor Tanya Sorden is the Dean of Newcastle University Law School, and she's been keenly following and researching a recent boom in AI justice apps, including ones designed to help couples sort out their divorce.
There are already justice apps that people can use in different sorts of ways as a backgrounder, if you like, in terms of their divorces. And they can help them set up calendars in relation to shared childcare or responsibilities, and can also help sometimes people communicate in different ways.
And are these commercial apps predominantly, or are some of them developed by government agencies?
Amica has been developed by the government, but in relation to a semi-commercial agency, and Adieu has been developed as a commercial product, although there was innovation funding that came from the state government, Queensland government, I think initially in relation to Adieu.
What are these apps actually offering to people? How do they work exactly?
Well, the apps differ from one to another, as one would expect. The Adieu app has a number of different features to it. So it has an online chatbot style of robot, which also has the capacity to do voice-to-text transmissions. So it asks a series of questions, and while you're responding to those questions, it's populating documents in the background that could eventually be used in court processes if that's what you decide to do. It then sends an invitation to your former partner, who can then decide whether or not they want to also use the app. And then once that process takes place and people decide that they want to use the app, people can be referred to other services if they need to be referred to other services. And if people get to a point, for example, that they've already reached some rough agreement on how they want to divide up the assets, there are sophisticated forms of AI which can really let you know whether or not what you've agreed upon is in sync with the norm. In addition to that, there's an add-on, if you like, app which looks at all financial contributions that the couple have made by essentially reviewing bank records and other account statements, and can give you a summary of what the contributions have been between a couple over the last 5 years, and can also help to set up options in relation to budgets. So a key part of that app is that there is quite a lot of focus on referral to human beings on the way through if people need that. Now, that particular program, the Adieu program, has already led to consent orders that have been produced with the support of the AI system being lodged in the court system so that people can have unbundled legal advice on the way through if they want it or they need it. And they can also have access to, you know, counsellors or mediators or accountants if they need that as well. So that's a bit more of a full service and referral model. The Amica app, which is the one which was recently launched by the Commonwealth Government, is a little more focused on using AI to determine whether or not an agreement is fair in the context of data that the app has been fed with. And the app initially was fed with court decision data, but that of itself is quite problematic because often the cases that end up with a full court decision are unusual in some respects. Otherwise, people will often settle before they end up in a court decision. So the scope of data was then expanded to include material from solicitors' files. So it's a broader base of data. And again, that one's more focused on really determining and informing a couple who might be negotiating, for example, in terms of the assets that they've got in the division of those assets, about what would be a reasonable and fair split.
And in what circumstances are these apps likely to be used? What sort of cases are they likely to be useful in?
There are real issues with using these apps in very complex cases. So in situations where there are a range of people involved, it's not just the couple, for example, they're a grandparent and other significant issues, but also in matters where, for example, a couple has a business on the side and they're looking to see how that business could be divided up, or they've got very complex superannuation arrangements. In addition, and probably most problematic, is where you've got high conflict cases. And that is where you've got cases where people are physically violent, or there may be significant levels of mental distress, and in fact, there may be mental health issues. And so in relation to those types of matters, an app might be useful in terms of keeping people at a distance, but at the same time, there will always be a need for judges in the family system, and there will always be a need for lawyers in the family system.
Why would people want to take this avenue? Why would they want to use an app rather than seek a human legal expert?
The research I've done really shows that they can save quite a lot of time and cost. And indeed, even some of the lawyers who were surveyed as part of the ADU project indicated that the time savings could be up to 6 months just using the one-click financial disclosure arrangement, where realistically you've got a form of AI that assesses all of the documents. And the cost savings there are because typically lawyers would send financial records between one another to try and work out what the contributions range is. And it can take quite a lot of time to do that. And it can also, I think, be quite costly in terms of sending those documents backwards and forwards. So by far the most significant advantages are in relation to cost and time advantages. In addition to that, there's probably advantages in relation to some where you've got more sensitive referral to human beings when you need them.
Okay, so time and cost are the main advantages. What are some of the disadvantages, though, that you found?
Well, there are definitely disadvantages anyway with the use of justice apps more generally in terms of the digital divide. That is, not everybody's online and not everybody is able to access services in the same way. They might not have the same bandwidth, and that can be, I think, very problematic for still a proportion of the population. There are other disadvantages, I think, that are related to people who may not be that literate in terms of English. And as at present, most of the apps are really designed for an English-speaking population. So these are some disadvantages that are linked to digital divide issues, which also can be related to digital literacy. Although I must say I was a bit surprised about digital literacy, because I really thought in my research that it would be mainly younger people who would use those apps. And I was surprised at the number of people who had been in a relationship for a long time and therefore were older who were also using the apps. So disadvantages in terms of digital literacy, disadvantages in terms of the digital divide. And then some of the other disadvantages are that if you've got, for example, children and you're in a continuing relationship, there are real benefits in working out how to communicate together so that you can manage any relationship issues or any child issues that emerge into the future. So there's a strong reason, or there are strong reasons, why you would want to keep humans as part of the solution, just so really your communication could be enhanced into the future.
AI has been controversially used in criminal cases for sentencing purposes, and also targeted policing and recruitment, those kinds of things. And there have been biases that have been established or suggested with the use of apps in those cases. Are there similar issues around bias with justice apps?
It's interesting because a lot of people were concerned about some of the deficiencies in terms of forms of AI that are used for sentencing or parole or even some other decisions, which are in widespread use in the US in particular. and to a lesser extent in many other countries. And these are legitimate concerns that, in a sense, some of these forms of AI might replicate bias that is already happening. There might be a bias against a person of colour, or that there might be a gender bias. And to some extent, it really depends on what the AI is fed with in terms of data. You're more likely to get issues of bias if, in fact, the data that you're actually feeding into the form of AI is biased data. So this is an issue with all forms of AI, in that it needs to be, I think, carefully thought out what data is actually being used to inform the development of the AI. At the same time, though, there are issues of bias across the court system. I don't think anybody would disagree with that. And in the family law area in particular, people will complain about bias. Now, there's a gap between perception and reality. However, there is also research that suggests that, for example, a judge's decision-making might be influenced by what they've had to eat that day, how many decisions they've had to make that day, for example, decision fatigue, or could be influenced by social appearance and other matters. So it's not to say that our court system or our judicial system is completely without bias. The question is whether or not AI systems are worse than our current system, or whether or not they offer some hope in terms of correcting bias.
And your verdict on that?
Look, I think it very much depends on the design of the AI systems and the extent to which really good ethical frameworks are incorporated, and there are clear frameworks in relation to values. There's also a piece in the context of Judge AI, which is really about whether AI should ever be used in relation to some matters. And I think that's a very interesting question and an appropriate question for us to be asking at this point in time in terms of AI development. It seems much more likely that, for example, Judge AI might replace judges at lower levels, so that lower court matters are eventually dealt with by a form of Judge AI. But that is also problematic in terms of what people's experience is of justice. And some of these justice apps also raise similar issues. To what extent do people really need to be listened to? To what extent is that important in terms of having connection with another person? You know, how is this affected by the use of AI?
Is AI being used in that form of judging at the moment, or is this just speculative at this stage?
It's a little speculative, although, you know, some countries have come up with some different approaches. So Estonia has explored Judge AI and is building a system. And in China, there are forms of AI that are already being used to nudge or correct judicial decision making, which I think there are concerns about. There are lower level AI decision making processes in the administrative area. And what happens with those sometimes is that you've got a human who may in fact be supervising the AI, but sometimes that human is kept out of the loop and is not what they call on the loop either.
Professor Tanya Sorden from the University of Newcastle, thank you very much for joining us.
It's been delightful. Thank you, Anthony.
And Professor Sorden has written a book on the subject we've just been discussing. It's called Justice Apps. What else? And it's out around early November. A steady growth in the use of decision-making AI is also a feature of modern sport. And it's the focus of Sam Robertson's work as a data scientist at Victoria University.
We've known for a very long time that psychologically and cognitively humans don't make great sense of all of this data that's surrounding us these days. There's limitations to what we can take in. So one of the main things that artificial intelligence, it's not just machine learning, it's also computers in general, will help us to make sense of that data and also do so objectively.
When you talk about decision making, you're talking about the calculations made by players, not just coaches and team managers, aren't you?
We're talking about all of those different stakeholders, and obviously the way in which they make decisions is quite different. An athlete on the football field, for example, has a microsecond to make a decision, and they aren't thinking about risk and reward necessarily, certainly not consciously when they're in those environments. But then they're still making decisions on a day-to-day basis with respect to what food they're putting into their body, what type of training they're going to do, how they're going to learn. So that's the type of decision-making that we're talking about with athletes. But then, of course, with respect to administrators, there's all sorts of operational decisions, for example, like how long to contract a player for, for in a team sport. We're always thinking about forecasting what an athlete, what an 18-year-old athlete is going to be like when they're 28, for example. So there's a whole rich landscape of different types of decisions that these people in working in sport are facing.
Let's just start with athletes. I mean, we're talking about ubiquitous sensors, aren't we? Multiple sensors on players as they're going about their activities on the field.
Yeah, absolutely. So GPS is perhaps the most well-known example of that. Any listeners that are familiar with the AFL or the NRL have seen those as part of the broadcast. And certainly, you know, the Australian Open Tennis is another good example of that. But again, there's also inertial sensors which measure acceleration. So it's not just the position of the athletes, but acceleration of different senses, different limbs, of different joint segments in the body as well. So there's a real widespread application of these sensors beyond just tracking an athlete from their performance perspective, but also for media and broadcast.
Injury in sport is, of course, a major problem. How can this form of analytics help us to deal with that issue and to perhaps prevent injury?
I think there's three main things, and I talk about these a lot with respect to solving some of the biggest problems in sport. One of which is that we need to improve the quality of the inputs that we're using in our models. So that is an example of when we are trying to look at the risk that an athlete has of being injured, we invariably look at some of the data that we've derived from the sensors we've talked about already, so things from GPS tracking. But the reality is they don't tell us what's going on inside the body. They don't tell us what's going on at the joint or inside those internal structures. And quite frankly, we will get there in terms of technology. We will have intramuscular sensors available for use in competition at some point in time where we can actually embed them under the skin of the body. But right now, we don't have that. So to me, a problem like injury requires not only better models and better algorithms, but it also requires better inputs coming from that technology. And then, of course, the third piece in this is that we need the stakeholders to trust the decisions from the algorithms or from the outputs as well.
And is there thought going into when that kind of sports analytics might potentially cross a line and start having the same kind of impact on a sport or on an athlete as performing enhancing drugs, say?
This is a very multifaceted area of research, particularly for sports ethics, which is, I think, what you're alluding to there. It does evoke these questions with respect to when does a human stop being a human and start being an augmented, something that's augmented beyond what is a normal human capability. And I think we've seen this in the use of prosthetic limbs in the past. We're having that debate right now with respect to gender as well. So it's extremely controversial and it needs a lot of different perspectives from a lot of different people. It's certainly one that we need a lot of attention from a lot of different stakeholders on, both now and into the future, because the future is really upon us with this space already.
Moving to coaches and to team management, how useful is sports analytics for recruitment?
Well, it's incredibly useful. And I think if we look at world football, the global code of football right now, in particular in Europe, Liverpool has come off a successful Premier League win in England, and their claim to fame has been very much around their recruitment. They've recruited quite heavily off the field in terms of data science. And, correlation is not causation here, but certainly there's a lot of good media and a lot of good stories around their success that they've had in that area.
There is an old adage that a little bit of knowledge can be a dangerous thing. Is there a possibility that people can take the approaches from sports analytics, clubs and, you know, various coaches and not follow them through correctly, and in doing so can actually cause more problems than benefits?
I think that's a very real consideration, and I don't doubt that that's being behind some of the apprehension on many potential stakeholders through their lack of adoption. If you have a record or have an ability to know that an athlete was at risk of being injured, to use our previous example, and you decided to not take action against that to help prevent that injury, you may well be liable. And I think this is a very big shift to the way that people have done business in many sports for a long time. So I'd understand why there'd be apprehension around that. And I think concussion is a good example of this. There's many sensors that we see now available in sport which can measure whether an athlete has experienced a concussion or not. And of course, if we have a sport out there, without naming any sport specifically, that is systematically causing concussions and long-term damage, brain damage to athletes, and a league was to know about that through some form of analytics and decision-making, then has a potential to cause fundamental disruption to that league.
Sam Robertson, a professor of sports analytics at Victoria University. To be honest, we don't cover a lot of sports-related material on this program, but if that's your interest, check out our companion program and podcast, Sporty with Amanda Smith. It's a weekly guide to the powerful place of sport and fitness in Australian cultural life. Just search the words Sporty and Radio National and you're sure to find it. In the meantime, you're listening to Future Tense. I'm Anthony Fennell. And now it's time to drone on about drones. Let's start with an innovative new way of operating them. It's a control device called the Takuma Orb. It's been designed by the startup Takuma Tech, and Annette McClelland is the company's co-founder.
So with a standard drone controller or remote controller, you usually have two joysticks to control the device, usually 4 degrees in a drone, up, down, forward, backward, left, right, roll, yaw. But what we allow you to do is replace up to 3 joysticks with one of our Takuma orbs.
And it looks like a ball on a stick, doesn't it? There appears to be no knobs or levers, etc. So how does it actually operate?
So we use tactile force-based control. So you push it in different directions and it uses force and torque to recognise the effort that you're putting in those directions.
It's able to be operated by one hand. What are the advantages there?
So that means this now allows any person to use their other hand to control a peripheral attached to the device, such as a camera, a robotic arm, or sensor system, or another device entirely. So that means your other hand is now free to do the other jobs associated with controlling your device.
And this was designed with drones in mind, wasn't it? But can it be adapted for other robotic devices?
Yes. So originally, my co-founder, Michael Griffin, was finding it difficult to control a drone and the camera at the same time, and that's how he came about the invention. But we have applied it to other technologies, such as robotic arms, sensor systems, underwater rovers in particular, and robotics in general.
Because it's a tactile control system and it appears to be very easy to use from the video I've seen online, are there advantages for people with disabilities? Will this make it easier for somebody who has a disability to use a drone, say?
Yes. So we have tested this with people with multiple sclerosis and other neurological disabilities and found that they were able to entirely control robots and drones with one hand in a couple of minutes.
Why has it taken so long for somebody like yourself to come up with a new idea for the remote control?
People have been trying to invent different ways to control drones, whether that be gesture control, voice control, other methods of programming it with GPS locations before a run or something like that. But the current two-joystick interface has existed for over 80 years since the end of World War I. So when people train sometimes decades to be competent on something, I think it just is difficult for people to see a different way.
Annette McClelland, co-founder of the company Takuma Tech. There's a link to a video demonstration on our website if you're interested. Now, in the not-too-distant future, you might be able to use one of Annette's orbs to control the tiny, weeny drone that Javan Chal has been developing at the University of South Australia. It's biologically inspired, and in some ways, it's more like a robotic insect than a traditional flying machine.
It's an approximately 20-gram flapping wing aircraft. I guess when it's flying, it actually does look a little bit like an insect. So it has 4 wings and they clap together. So they're not arranged like in a dragonfly where there's one wing pair in front of the other. The wings actually clap together, which gives a little bit more thrust. And what's unusual about this device is it's the first one to show really high maneuverability in a flapping wing aircraft, and it's achieved that through a range of efficiencies that we introduced that allowed it to be fast enough to actually do high performance maneuvers.
Could I get you just to explain the mechanics behind this prototype, how it actually moves through the air?
Sure. So it's got the clapping wing that generates a sort of pulse of thrust when the wings clap together, and then simultaneously when it's in forward flight, those 2 wings are also lifting like the wings of a fixed-wing aircraft. At the back is a large tail, and that tail allows it to rotate in the pitch direction. So it can pitch up so that it can do this rapid zoom climbing maneuver, which we demonstrated, which is the first really aggressive aerobatic maneuver by a flapping-wing aircraft. So driving the wings is a motor with a gearbox And that gearbox was actually the source of most of the optimization. Previously, people had used gearboxes and they didn't know where the energy was going. And it turned out a lot of the energy was being wasted by the gearbox rocking. So there's the gears coming in and out of contact with each other and jamming up as the variable load of the wing as it claps and reciprocates. And that was a large part of our contribution, was just realizing where the losses were and then rectifying that problem.
As you say, this prototype, it's very small, isn't it? Why is that?
Well, we want it to be small. That's the goal, is flight at this sort of unknown small domain. One of the issues with drones in general is that a lot's known about large aeroplanes, but there's this insect size, which is really not very well known. But the insect size is useful because it's low cost. It allows you to get into small places and operate safely around people and infrastructure. Flapping wings have the advantage that they can both hover and fly a reasonable distance, like insects, like birds. They have an ability to hover and an ability to fly a long way, and that's very attractive for a lot of missions.
So it flaps its wings. It's very small, like an insect. What are the possible uses for this type of drone?
Well, there's an obvious one in that sort of defence and surveillance and security space. But one nice thing about this project is most of the talk has been about, well, if you had a very small drone, what else could you do beyond the obvious? And so one of the interesting ideas that came up was pollinating vertical gardens, because, you know, in some environments it's difficult for insects to even get access, let alone to pollinate in a normal way. So and maybe vertical, you could use them for that.
Vertical gardens, you mean like vertical farms where a produce is stacked on layers, one above the other,
yes,
indoors?
Exactly. There's quite a lot of interest in that in parts of the world where there's a high density of people, and then vertical surfaces become interesting. And so that was an idea. There was another idea, which was to fly around delicate infrastructure. So quadrotors potentially can do some damage with their rotors. There are a lot of hard parts in them. The tip velocities of the rotors are quite high. Fixed wings can't even operate in a cluttered environment. So the idea was these fairly soft, flexible things might be a good thing to put in delicate places, maybe where there's a lot of wiring or amongst aeroplanes, inside aeroplanes that are being maintained, that kind of application. But I think there's many more wherever there's people. So wherever there are people and you want to fly close to them, having flexible wingtips and a light weight is a really good thing.
In a way, we've almost come full circle, haven't we? Because when people first started thinking about the possibility of human flight, they thought of flapping wing machines. We moved away from that. And now it seems as though, in one sense at least, we're coming back to that idea again.
I think it's a lot of other things have been done. And there's a whole skill set there in aeronautics and aerodynamics that wants to be applied in terms of research. I have an interest in it because I've had a long-term interest in trying to unlock some of the capabilities of biology and put it into engineering. But I think for others, there's not much left to do on large aircraft. There's been 100 years of continuous refinement, sometimes under enormous pressure like wars and things. That is a very mature field. So where do you do the research? And so there's a lot of space at the bottom. We think about insects like the size of dragonflies, but there's insects that have 1 millimeter, 1.5 millimeter wingspans, tiny, tiny insects. The wings don't even look like wings. They look like brushes. So you get down to the point where they swim through the air. They don't fly through the air. So there's a lot of space there for understanding of new things and unlocking new knowledge.
Professor Javan Chahal from the University of South Australia, thank you very much for joining us. It's fascinating.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
It flaps and it claps. It doesn't buzz. But I reckon some people will still find it annoying. That's Future Tense for another week. Our producer was Karin Zsivanovits. No matter where you are, no matter what your level of isolation, stay safe and take care. I'm Anthony Fennell. Until next time, cheers.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.